So it's really fun to be here. I like seeing you guys every once in a while. Barbara called me and said, "What are you going to talk about?" And I thought, "Oh my gosh, I hadn't given it any thought." I was about to go back to Barry for a couple of weeks. So I said, "Well, let's talk about the refuges, because people don't often talk about them, and yet they're part of all this ritual that we are involved with." You know, taking the refuges. I like the verb, we take them. Taking the refuges is sort of the way in which we affirm our place on the Buddhist path. We take the refuges, and we usually recite them ritually. I take refuge in the Buddha, I take refuge in the Dharma, I take refuge in the Sangha. And I don't know I haven't heard a lot of thinking about what that means. So that's what I thought I would talk about tonight, to sort of articulate the notion of the refuges as a subject for investigation. What does it really mean when we say, "I take refuge"? We do it devotionally. So it becomes a devotional practice. But I'd like to make it more wisdom practice. So what do we mean by a refuge? Take refuge from what?
When you say devotional practice, could you just spell that out more?
By a devotional practice, I'm thinking of something we do ritually as a reflection of our commitment to the path. It's not particularly investigative. It's an affirmation. I take refuge in the Buddha, and I'm thinking, let's unpack this a little. Is that helpful?
Very.
So, you know, taking refuge is, we sort of viscerally know. I like Bruce Springsteen. "Times are tough, just getting tougher. This world is rough, just getting rougher. Cover me, come on baby, cover me."
That's a great song.
"This whole world is out there just trying to score. I've seen enough, don't want to see anymore. Cover me." Yeah. Other refuges that we take: food, comfort food, shopping, work. You know, in Hawaii, have anybody been to the City of Refuge? It's on the Big Island, right? Mm-hmm. And apparently, if you it's on Kauai. It's in Hawaii. It's on a beach. If you did something egregious and, like, let your shadow fall on the king, which was, I gather, a death sentence, mm-hmm, the time, if you could get to the City of Refuge, which is maybe 5 or 6 acres on the beach with a little wall around it, if you could get there, you were safe. Refuge is a place of safety. So, you know, what refuge from what? Now, I think the Buddha was talking about this in the so-called First Noble Truth. He didn't define the truth. This so-called truth is often described as the truth of suffering, the truth of dukkha. Dukkha being the Pali word that the Buddha used to describe the dissatisfaction that we have with life. It just won't do it like we want. Or is it just me? No, it's not me. So he didn't do a definition. It's not like a dictionary. He made a list of things. So in the first truth, birth, aging, sickness, death, pain. Anybody got any of that? Sorrow? Yeah. Distress. Lamentation, despair. Oh, let's not leave out not getting what you want. Or getting what you don't want. And losing what you cherish. These are they're on all of our dance cards, but like, who wants it? You know? These are the experiences that we, you know, because we're human and we live in this world, this comes with the territory. So he didn't define it, but he gave us a list of the things that are unsatisfactory. And we're stuck with this. Unless one of you has figured a way, these things come to our lives. So, in what sense, and they're painful, in what sense is the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha safety from that, refuge from that? The Buddha as a refuge. You know, the Buddha isn't alive right now, so the Buddha for each of us is an idea we have of him. So each of us probably has a slightly different idea. You know, and when we talk about the Buddha, we think the other person's thinking the same thing that we're thinking when we're thinking about the Buddha, but who knows? So it seems to me that the refuge, the way in which the Buddha could serve as a refuge, is if we have, is in terms of the way we understand what he accomplished. You know, what did he do? You know, how did he freed himself from suffering? He found a refuge from suffering. And our idea of what he attained. Now, not everybody has the same idea. I say this, I'll probably come back to that again, particularly when we talk about the Dharma. But, you know, often we just sort of say, well, the Buddha, he was enlightened. You know? And we sort of let it go at that. What does it mean? What happened in his mind? You know, Thich Nhat Hanh says, just because the Buddha was a human means that there can be countless Buddhas. You know, but what does that enlightenment mean? He was enlightened, awakened. Does it mean the same thing? He found Nibbana, discovered Nibbana. What does that mean? Do we really know? So I think it's, in a way, the refuge is in what we think we're doing in order to deal with the suffering that comes to our lives, with the dissatisfaction. We'll talk a little bit about where that dissatisfaction comes from. But generally seems to be, what did the Buddha, as you understand what he accomplished, the extent to which you understand or have an idea of what he accomplished, will have to do with the inspiration for your practice. If you think that he did something transcendent, that, you know, sort of, I mean, what is enlightenment? I'll talk a little bit about enlightenment, the word, but if you think it's some sort of blissful state in which there's no more pain and suffering, and, you know, the Buddha died in pain. He just didn't complain. I actually think, I think the Buddha lived, this is my own thinking now, and for us, if it's helpful to you, I think the Buddha lived a complaint-free life. Pretty high bar. But he wasn't disturbed by stuff that happened, like when his cousin tried to kill him and pushed a rock onto him and it crushed his foot. That hurts. And he had a bad back, and there were times when he couldn't go and give the Dharma talk because his back was hurting. But, you know, there's some some text in the Sutta Nipata, which I thought I'd read. It's the qualities of a sage. This very early text, somebody says, so tell me about the perfect man. So I'll just read a little bit just to give you a sense. A man who is calmed, who has extinguished all his cravings before the time his body disintegrates into nothing. Who has no concern with how things began or with how they will end, and no fixation on what happens in between. Such a man has no preferences. He has no anger, no fear, and no pride. Nothing disturbs his composure, and nothing gives him cause for regret. He has no longing for the future, no grief for the past. There are no views or opinions that lead him. That's pretty good. Because mainly, we're looking for some opinions. We have some good opinions. He's not a man who's full of himself or a man who's addicted to pleasure. He's a man who's gentle and alert, with no blind faith, shows no aversion to anything. It goes on. Sutta Nipata, I just recommend, just because. So I think it's important to have an idea of what the, however you understand it, but just to recognize, because that's the idea you have of where you're headed. You know, if you don't know where you're going, it's the words of that great yogi, Vera. If you don't know where you're going, you're liable to wind up somewhere else. But there are differences of opinion about what the Buddha attained. Let me just give you an example about Nibbana. That's what he supposedly attained, right? So Bhikkhu Bodhi's understanding of Nibbana, this is on his website. Regarding the nature of Nibbana, the question is often asked, does Nibbana signify only the extinction of the defilements and the liberation from samsara, or does it signify some reality existing in itself? Nibbana is not only the destruction of defilements and the end of samsara, but a reality transcendent to all the entire world of mundane experience, a reality transcendent to all the realms of phenomenal existence. So that's an opinion that's floating out there. Personally, I'm not sure how, if it's transcendent to the entire world of our experience, how you'd know it was there. There's a great sutta in the Dīghanikāya, the Tibhija Sutta, where these Brahmins come to the Buddha and say, our teachers teach about Brahman. And the Buddha says, well, if your teachers, have you ever met Brahman face to face? Well, no. But about your teachers, have they? Yeah, no, not them. Well, then, their teachers? No, I don't think they've met. Buddha says, and the quote, it's a translation, but the translation, he says, this can't be right. I have a different perception. This is the Buddha. Just the Buddha from this suttas, and we'll talk about the credibility of the suttas briefly. But this is here. When one experiences the remainderless destruction of greed, the remainderless destruction of hatred, and the remainderless destruction of delusion, it is in this way that Nibbana is directly visible, immediate, applicable, and to be personally experienced by the wise. There are different opinions. And they will lead in different directions. They will lead your practice in different directions. So if you think that your goal is to become one with the cosmos, then you'll practice a different kind of meditation. You'll be trying, you know, I think that a lot of concentration practice, which you know, concentration practice existed prior to the Buddha. It was used to bring yourself to the state of neither existence nor non-existence, to perception nor non-perception, so that you would learn how to be with that experience when you die, so that you could become one with the oneness of all things. The Buddha was more a mindfulness kind of guy. I'll talk about that in a bit. His words, Sariputta said the same thing, asked about Nibbana and arhatship. It's the destruction of greed, the destruction. The destruction doesn't come back. So enlightenment, here we give you, offer this as a there's a point at which you personally know what needs to be done. You know the task that is at hand. And you can practice it with or without a teacher. You know what you have to do. The waking up to the path, to the task, I understand is enlightenment. Liberation is when you're done. After you've been working at it, and you're free. So I make that kind of a distinction. Might be, you know, the Buddha was asked once by some guy, it's in the Majjhima, so somebody asked him, besides you and your monks, anybody else get this? It's a loose translation. But basically, the response was, Buddha says, there are not only 100 or 500, but far more lay followers, my disciples, clothed in white, enjoying sensual pleasures, who carry out my instruction, respond to my advice, have gone beyond doubt. So they know what there is to do personally, they know directly. Gone beyond doubt, become free from perplexity, gained intrepidity, because there's nothing else to do really when you spot it, and become independent of others in the teacher's dispensation. So that's, you know, that's stream entry. And there's been probably, in my view, some stream entry inflation over the years.
How does that work?
Well, you know, it starts stream entry in terms of the fetters. Now this is, we're moving into the Dharma, but it's the abandonment of a belief in rites and rituals. The recognition of the illusory nature of personality, and the end to doubt. In other words, the end to doubt in the path. You know what to do. You know what to work on. So the refuge in the Buddha is refuge in the idea of, you know, what you can accomplish, what freedom means. And I think over time, our understanding of this will deepen. Refuge in the Dharma. Well, refuge in the Dharma is a little different. The Dharma is the teaching. Refuge in the Dharma is refuge in the idea that there is a path, there's a way to do what the Buddha did. Not random. But then the question is, what did he say? I mean, we are here 2,500 years later. Oh, by the way, I just discovered this recently. The Buddha's, and you can discover it for yourself, I'll do the math. The Buddha, now scholars say, was born about 484 BC. So if you add 2015 to 484, you get 2,500?
Yeah. 2499.
Yeah. So this upcoming year is the 2500th year since the Buddha's birth. So just somebody was putting those dates up and I thought, geez. So we go to the Dharma for refuge. We go to the teachings to learn how to attain what the Buddha attained. Although it's sort of important to get the right instructions. So how do we know? You know, what is right view? Right view is the first element of the Eightfold Path. Really, refuge in the Dharma is refuge in right view, which will deepen over time as we practice and insight develops. But the way in which you understand the path will determine your practice. You know, if you're seeking something transcendent, it's going to be different than if you're seeking to just perceive what's present. So we've got this map and we've got instructions. And we've got this 2500 year game of telephone that has brought us. The game of telephone is a metaphor for, you know, how the teachings appear to us. They've been tweaked and added to. We're doing it ourselves, you know. How many times have you seen somebody read the text? Well, the Metta Sutta, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, but the texts say son. And we're already tinkering a little bit because of our social sensibilities. Not inappropriate, but that kind of tweaking has been going on for a while. How do we know what the Buddha actually taught? It's tricky. The one thing that there's consensus on is that the Buddha taught about suffering and the end of suffering, dissatisfaction, and the ending of dissatisfaction. And he articulated that in the four so-called truths. The four truths which, you know, talk about suffering, the response, the origin of suffering, and the cessation, and the path. So the Dharma actually is the path, the Eightfold Path. It's not entirely clear. People trying to figure out what the Buddha taught as clearly as possible. Bhikkhu Anālayo, who's just a prodigious scholar and amazing, he just says, I'm not going to pay attention to anything. Post-Ashoka is the way he puts it. About 200 years after the Buddha's death, Ashoka, who was king of a huge hunk of India, maybe 70%, 60%, just a huge, he was a major, he became interested in the Buddhist teachings. And after that, there was lots more interest, lots more commentary, lots more, and he's just not interested in anything late. Or you get someone like Stephen Batchelor, who I really appreciate, and he says, okay, let's take a look at what was present at the time of the Buddha. And then let's look at what, I mean, figure that that was already there, and then look at what the Buddha added to the mix and say, that's what he added. And when he takes a look at that, it's pretty interesting. Because ambient at the time, you know, we think of the Buddha, the four precepts, the first four precepts, not to kill, not to steal, not to engage in harmful sexual behavior, not to lie. And then we add that last one on there. This is a country that tried temperance, right? I understand. Lee Brasington was saying, just when I saw him in Barry last week, that the first iterations of that fifth precept were not to walk on seeds. You know, the monks would walk around and they'd trample the farmers' seeds. But those first four were ambient. They're the same oaths that the Jains took. The Buddha flipped the meaning. He said it wasn't so much the commandment. It was the intention that you bring to it. But he taught that you had to free yourself. The Brahmins couldn't conduct a ritual. There's no intermediary between you and any other thing. You have to. You're responsible for your own liberation. The Buddhas can only point the way. The Tathagatas can only point the way. The Dharma is like a finger pointing at the moon. It's an old Zen story. Dharma is like a finger pointing at the moon. But we mistake the finger for the moon. So we grab onto the text and we argue over the texts and what they mean. And we're not looking for the moon. And that finger ought to be pointing, close to the right direction. If it's pointing at the sun, it's probably not going to help. And if it's sort of gesturing over in that direction, and the instructions need to be correct. So personal responsibility important, and the mindfulness practice that we do. He added, it was not like the jhana practices that were done at the time. So he found that stability, samasamadhi, the eighth element of the path, right concentration. There's scholars that I'm fans of course, translate that as indistractability. But mindfulness is his addition. The conscious attention, paying attention to the experience that's present. Attending to the impermanent, the unsatisfactory and insubstantial, empty nature of our experience. That emptiness was part of what he added to the mix as well. Dependent origination, the notion that all manifestations are dependently arisen. Nothing stands separate from everything else. Everything is changing. And of course that means there aren't any things. Things are just snapshots of a process that's unfolding continually. It's just happening. That dependent origination, the embeddedness of, we are dependent on the Big Bang, for crying out loud. how embedded are we? The iron in your blood can only have been manufactured in this universe in an exploding star. Carl Sagan, we are star stuff. We're just the current manifestation of the Big Bang. Everything is changing, insubstantial. That dependent origination. We aren't separate from our environment, as we're learning. And he ethicized behavior. Right speech, right action, right livelihood. Almost half the path is about how we live in this world. And it's not, the precept practice starts as an elementary practice. Don't kill, don't steal. Well, as the Buddha said once, there's this great sutta where some Brahmin comes to him and says, my teacher doesn't kill. He says, not killing, not lying, these are the, and the Buddha says, a stupid baby boy doesn't do any of those things either. So you would say a stupid baby boy has reached the pinnacle of ethical practice. You can Google stupid. I don't know whether Tan Jeff has it, so you might not be able to find it on Access to Insight, but it's in the Majjhima. So he said that what's important is the intention behind the action, because you can't be sure how things are going to come out. you know, the doctor who performed surgery on Joan Rivers, that wasn't planning. You know, so when you say do no harm, it's not do no harm, it's don't intend harm. Look at your intentions. So the recipe is the Eightfold Path, really, seems to me. You know, crafting right view, an understanding that enables you to live without suffering, that enables you to live without making things worse. What is that understanding? There are scholars who have suggested that our progress on the path is measured by the depth of our understanding of right view, our understanding of the Dharma, because right view is our view of the Dharma. The Dharma is a refuge, is our understanding of the path, the way in which we can become like the Buddha. We can become. Thich Nhat Hanh said, I love that quote, because the Buddha was a person. Now, you know, you read in the scriptures, you know, the Buddha was magical and he did all these. But you got to, you know, remember, after the Buddha was dead, in order for his followers to gain the patronage of the wealthy people in the neighborhood, they sort of had to play a my guru is just as good as your guru kind of game. And so, you know, there are magical, supernatural things that are described. For myself, I like to run these things by my experience, by my own experience. I think in some ways the Dharma is Dharma's perspective is phenomenological and not metaphysical. It means it's subjective, you know? Peter Jennings, it's hard to footnote him because it went by on the TV once, but, you know, I heard him say, and if I was forced into it in a court of law, I could come up with it, but I heard him say, objectivity means different things to different people. So, your objectivity is a subjective experience of yours. And if we can be, in that sense, purely phenomenological, purely subjective, it doesn't mean solipsistic, because, but our experience of the world, then doubt is overcome. Because you may not know whether the Dalai Lama, you know, they having found that he was the Dalai Lama, they put his eyeglasses down, he was 8 or something like this, and they put his eyeglasses down and his false teeth down and a few other things, and he picked them out. And they said, oh, it shows that he remembers them from his past life. So I may not know whether he knew them from their past life or he was reading the mind of the person who brought them, and, you know, he knew it that way, or whether it was just a lucky guess. I may not know. But I'm absolutely certain I don't know. So when we are willing to engage our own subjectivity fully, and there's just unfolding, there's no objects there, and doubt, there's no need for doubt. We can be totally clear about what we believe and what we don't. And we can investigate the bases for that belief. One of the biggest clues to his teaching, you know, not a lot made of it, but the Buddha said in several places, and I don't think I brought the quotes, but if you need the citations, he said, I teach a Dharma that does not contend with anyone, that does not dispute with anyone. Imagine how you could be in a position that does not dispute with others. The world may dispute with me, but I do not dispute with the world. it's even better than not complaining. But if you only claim that your knowledge, your understanding is your understanding, well then, and somebody else's understanding is somebody else's understanding, and they're welcome to it. So there are just a lot of different perspectives on the teachings, on the Dharma. But it seems to me that to take refuge in the Dharma means to find relief in the idea that there is a way to attain what the Buddha attained, what we understand the Buddha to attain. And, you know, when I look, I see the Eightfold Path. It's an Eightfold Path. Eightfold, each part as important. It's an integrated way of being. I may have used this metaphor once before. It's in our group in Davis, we call it the basketball. Here's the eightfold basketball. It's a sphere. It's about 15 inches across. It weighs a couple pounds. It's orange. It's made of rubber. It's got little dimples on it and black stripes. It's filled with compressed air. It weighs, is that eight? You can't separate them. You can't play with just the brown. No. It's the whole thing. So the Eightfold Path is a way of being without dukkha, without suffering. So the refuge of the Dharma is that there is a path, and that we are human. The Buddha was human. He did it. We can do it. Now, one of my friends, Musang, says that the most important decision the Buddha made was to remain a monk. And that's been a koan for me for a while. Because by reducing his needs to food, robes, clothing, shelter, and medicine, he set a standard that we can all look, you know, for me it's a navigational tool. Presumably, well, the Buddha's state of mind was not independent of the conditions in which he found himself. Arhats, I think, took a different form then than they do now. Living without suffering may look different today than it, you know, looked. But that's something to investigate. Refuge in the Sangha. Well, the Sangha is interesting. The Sangha initially meant just the collection of fully awakened arhats. That was the Sangha. The Sangha of awakened beings. And then over time it came to mean all those in robes, the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, who we now call monks and nuns. We call them monks and nuns because, you know, when the Christian missionaries got to India, they looked and they saw these people in robes and they said, oh, monks, nuns. We know what those people. Well, there's no word in Pali that translates as monk. Bhikkhu means beggar. The Christian missionaries, they saw monasteries where you go to be alone. They saw monasteries. Vihara is the word in Pali, and it means dwelling place to live. Not a place to be alone, actually. The Buddha sort of forced everybody to stay in interaction with the people who could feed them. So, you know, then the idea of the Sangha as those in robes still present. If you go to Vajrapani, which is a Tibetan monastery in the Santa Cruz Mountains, when you go through the food line, there's a little sign that says, out of respect, we serve Sangha first. It's still there. Now we think of Sangha as the community that gathers together to practice together and listen to the Dharma and study the Dharma together. It's where you go to get the Dharma. The refuge of the Sangha is the place where you go to find the Dharma. Sangha is where you find the Dharma. So in, you know, today, the Sangha is digital. My wife has friends who live in Australia near the outback. There isn't a Dharma center nearby, but they listen to Gil and Sylvia Borstein, and you know, they listen to the recordings. You know, there's books. I think of Sangha now as a culture of awakening. In the sociological, anthropological sense, it's the culture that supports our waking up to the task that we have to perform in order to be free from dukkha. In order to be free from our tendencies, let's face it, to make things worse. There's some difficulties though with Sangha. How do you know that the Sangha that you're hanging out with is not, well, Heaven's Gate? Remember Heaven's Gate? They were the people who, they drank the Kool-Aid themselves. They were in San Diego and they thought they were going to go to be on some flying saucer that was behind a comet that was coming by. That's an extreme. But you know, it's an interesting issue, because you know, some sanghas have teachers that what happens when you have problems with teachers? One friend of mine said, "Well, you've got the perfect teaching, and it's just an imperfect teacher." And I go back to the Dvija Sutta, which, you know, this can't be right. Perfect teaching sounds—that's a claim. It feels like advertising to me, you know? In the end, teachers teach you their understanding as best they can put it together. And in the end, you have to make the decision. It's not possible, you know, You have to recognize the path. The Buddha says it's not. Let's see if I brought that. It's really nice. Yeah. You know, there's the notion about the Sangha being all of the holy life. You heard that one? No. Buddha's standing around with Ananda, and they're looking out over the things, and Ananda says, "This Sangha is really cool. It's got to be half the holy life." And the Buddha says, "Don't say that. It's the entire holy life. Good friendship, good companionship, good comradeship. When a bhikkhu has a good friend, a good companion, a good comrade, it is to be expected that he will develop and cultivate the Eightfold Path." But then there's this other part where the Buddha says, this is in the Majjhima too, he says, if one can find a worthy friend, a virtuous, steadfast companion, if you can find a worthy Sangha, then overcome all threats of danger and walk with him content and mindful. But if one finds no worthy friend, no virtuous, steadfast companion, then as a king leaves his conquered realm, walk like a tusker in the woods alone. So, you know, right sangha is a koan. And it's something that we either make or we don't. I mean, we live with the sangha. There's no sangha separate from us. You know, as soon as you're part of the sangha, because you bring your perceptions to it. So in the end, you have to depend on yourself to recognize the Dharma. You're the only one who can free yourself. You know, in the West, we've got this notion that's really deep, the notion of original sin. And a lot of people, even if you weren't raised in those specific spiritual traditions, we sort of feel there's something wrong with us. In the East, it's a little different. The idea is more that we are originally pure, but we are visited by these defilements, greed, hatred, and delusion. And so our task is to dispel them, to not be tricked by them. And we're the only ones who can do that. There's no savior that can do it. If we're flawed, if we're inherently flawed, we need a savior. Because we can't, how can you do it if you're really broken? But if you're essentially fine, then you're the one that has to do it. You will free yourself to the extent that you commit your effort and practice. So refuge in the Sangha is refuge in the place, whatever it is that brings the Dharma to us. Refuge in the Dharma, there's a path, and refuge in the Buddha. Refuge from the unpleasantness, the unsatisfactoriness. Unsatisfactoriness. The world is the way it is. It's unsatisfactory coming from our side. Our complaints. That complaint-free, unsatisfactory. We got a complaint. The world is unsatisfactory. So, you know, the Buddha says he only points the way. The Tathagatas just tell you how you have to exert the energy. So we don't, you know, who knows how much time we have? What was that phrase that I read? Who knows the path, who's calm and attained before the body has totally broken down. It's already breaking down. You know, the breakdown of the body starts long before you're dead. If you're not noticing that yet. Hang in there a bit. It'll show up. So let me just pause and see what kinds of comments or thoughts this might have. But we've got some, you know, some time for some conversation. Oh. Yeah, please.
So there is a perfect Dharma.
There is?
Yes, there is.
And this is something that you know?
Yes.
And what is it?
It's it goes along with the phrase, become your own guru, be your own guru.
Yeah.
It comes from within.
That's the whole deal, I just get to be...
Well, that's what that's so far, that's my experience.
Mm-hmm.
And it could change in a moment.
Did you have?
Oh, you were talking at one point about if your goal was more transcendent than phenomenological.
Phenomenological?
If it was more transcendent, your practice would be one way. And if it was concentration, it might be another way. And it seemed like you were saying that that's you know, for the individual to discover that they're.
I didn't have
a judgment about which was.
Well, I do have a judgment.
Okay.
My assessment is that the mindfulness practice reveals impermanence and emptiness, and it shows the source of dissatisfaction in my own experience. I can engage it, I can recognize it in my own experience. Concentration practice, you know, it's our understanding. What I'm saying is that the way you understand things will determine how you live your life. If you think that you're going to make yourself happy by getting what you want, by fulfilling your dreams, you're going to be doing something different than if you think that the way to make yourself happy is to abandon all sensual desires. Right? I mean, you'll just be practicing differently. And that can be, there can be subtle differences too. You close your eyes if you're praying for a raise, it's very different than if you're wishing well for other people. So the way you understand the world will determine the way you practice. And the way you practice, of course, will determine.
Is it actually intent? It comes down to intent, yeah.
Your intent? Yeah. But your intent to do what?
Well, like I've been focusing and kind of getting stale with my meditation, daily meditation practice, and you just, when you said if you think about it, it's being transcendent versus concentration, it kind of just poof. But yeah, so I'm going to, and some kind of insight happens, so I'm going to apply that tomorrow and see.
Right.
Yeah.
Insight, you know, if you're looking for insight, it's different than if you're looking for complete stillness. And your practice will be different. You know, your practice will be different. That's what I'm suggesting. And I think that the insight practice, in fact, I think the word panya, which we normally see translated as wisdom, I think it translates better as deep knowing. You know, it's insight. Onion's insight, as I see it.
Does it have to be contradictory, though? Can, you know, as one works on oneself with insight, you know, I think of transcendence as feeling connected with the interconnectedness of life, notions like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't seem. What you're talking about as contradictory to that, or
right? Let me.
It's both and instead of
sure.
One or the other.
By transcendent, I was referring to the notion that the goal of practice is to attain something that is beyond the realm of our experience. You know, what that description of nirvana is something transcendent beyond what we can experience. But you can use the word transcendence metaphorically and say you no longer are contained within the constraints of the symbolic world you live in. Does that make sense? the world as we know it is a construction in our mind. So transcending that, you can understand that as just recognizing it as just a construction in our mind. Or you can think that the world as we know it is the way it is. However I think it is, that's that way.
I think it's how you use the word transcending.
Yeah, and sometimes when we talk about inner experience, it's tricky. If I say, cars love Shell, and I love you, what does love mean? You know? So we're sort of, the words don't point in the same way. So when we're talking about inner experience, often we use metaphor. It's sort of like this, you know, the weight of the world is on my shoulder. The weight of the world, not literally, but metaphorically. You know, so we use metaphor to talk about that, and it can be misunderstood. So, we need, you know, first thing is to be clear on ourselves about what we mean.
You said that you think there's been inflation of stream entry,
yeah.
And somebody asked, if, how does that work? And it sounded to me like you explained how what stream entry is. Can you explain what you mean by that there's inflation of stream
entry? Oh, yes. There, you know, the notion of stream entry, I have a friend who is a serious jhana practitioner, and he regards stream entry as some sort of the attainment of some particular exotic mind state. You know, and it becomes out of reach for most people. Nibbana becomes something, well, four or five lifetimes down if you keep your sila together and, you know, don't grab somebody else's parking space. You know, if you're good, in three or four lifetimes you may get to attain that transcendent, you may be in touch with that thing that is beyond all conditions. You know, when the Buddha talked about the unconditioned, you can look in the Samyutta Nikaya, he says, what is unconditioned? It's experience unconditioned by greed, hatred, and delusion. But you can make it some transcendent thing. So some of the inflation, I think, happens, you know, it's a way of creating spiritual hierarchy. I'm talking to God. and you know what he says, you got to get your act together. You know, and I'm wearing this robe, so I'm talking to God. So it creates I know and you don't. And it may not be that somebody may know and you don't, but to exercise it as in that way, it may not be helpful. Because to the extent that there is a perfect teaching, it's got to be expressed in words that are ambiguous. You know? To the extent that the Dharma is perfect, expressing it, maybe it's the way the Zen people do, you know, just smack you one. Yeah.
Well, it seems like if you're looking for that something out there, it's just perpetuating the problem. You're not actually looking at what's actually here.
I think I share that.
I mean, I've experienced that in previous meditation practices, and previous practices in general, religious practices in general. And what I keep finding is that those words that you talk about, that we talk about, like dependent origination and everything and all that, well, when you just sit still long enough, it starts and it feels big, but mostly I think for me anyway, it feels big because I go, oh, I've been making this whole story up about all this stuff all this time, and that's what this is.
It's a huge watershed moment for me when John Peacock, who's a British scholar, wrote on a whiteboard, he wrote, Nibbana equals upekkha. Nibbana is equanimity. It's the balancing life, the balanced life in the midst of the turbulence of change and the crazy valence of pleasant, unpleasant experience. And I asked Bhikkhu Bodhi what the difference was between Nibbana and upekkha, and he said upekkha is just a psychological state. Nibbana is transcendent. It's this other realm, this something else that's transcendent to our experience, beyond anything we can know. And I think, well then, how do we know it? So upekkha is it isn't a state of indifference, it isn't a state of numbness, it's an active engagement without greed, without needing our experience to be pleasant, without making unpleasant experience go away, and without thinking that everything is related to us.
That's the
delusional part. Bhikkhu Bodhi does say, he says, we spend all our time trying to make things more pleasant, to keep things from being unpleasant, and to figure out how this all just relates to me.
Yeah,
we take refuge, think about what we're doing with our practice. The refuges contain all of our practice, and you can use them as a framework for hanging your understanding on. Anything else? Any other questions? Please.
The composer John Cage said, quote, "Why are we here? Not why, just here."
Yeah, when you ask why are we here, when you ask a question like why, you know what you're going to get? Words. You are. If somebody answers, if you know. So the Buddha was more interested in what's going on. Just what's going on. Because at the point where you see yourself making things worse, they'll stop. We're slow. You're not stupid. Yeah.
Can I ask though, if our understanding of the Dharma is inherently subjective?
Yeah.
You've studied with teachers.
Mm-hmm.
You've described your subjective experience to them, and they have recognized certain patterns or certain features of that experience such that they acknowledge that you're making progress on a path. Isn't that true? I mean, there's got to be some shared common experience.
Well, you know, it's, we share the use of words. But if I say Donald Trump, your understanding is probably going to be different than that of the cab driver who took me to the airport who was just in love with Donald Trump. We think we're talking about the same guy, but really they're just different characters. When I say it's subjective, it's because your freedom from suffering is going to be subjective. It's a subjective experience, your dukkha. And so it's a subjective process. Your task is to figure out how to free yourself from it. So you can, you know, I'm not so sure what communication means. You know, we have a model in our mind that has maybe like telephone. You talk into one end and comes out at the other and they understand you. But, you know, if I use a word like Donald Trump, and the cab driver uses a word like Donald Trump, we think we're communicating. If I talk about enlightenment, say, oh yeah, I want to get enlightened. Yeah, me too. And we think we're talking about the same thing, but maybe not. If I say enlightenment should be your goal, say enlightenment should be your goal. I think that I've communicated to you something, that what's in my mind is now in your mind, but I'm making these noises, and you're seeing me make and listening, and it conjures up in your mind, based on your experiences, the conditions of your life and perspective. I'm not sure about,
But there, and I don't mean to get into a huge metaphysical debate or anything, but there's, let's take something complete, like love, okay? So my experience of love and your experience of love are probably not, I mean, they're going to be...
They're going to be different. Their lives different, are different. Okay?
But how many fingers am I holding up?
Well,
so that's something we can do. Most of us can agree on that. So there's, I'm just saying there's a continuum for these things that we can. So,
but if you say how many fingers am I holding, if I say it in a language that you don't understand, then you're looking at me going, should I know? So there are shared patterns of behavior, no question. We can look and see ourselves behaving cooperatively. I just think that we tend, that the metaphysical notion that there is an objective realm separate from our experience of it is a thought. And when we get into metaphysical issues, then we start saying, how are things really? The Buddha was not concerned with how things were really. He was concerned with our experience of them, and he was concerned particularly with our experience of dissatisfaction, of suffering, and how we can put an end to that in our lives. So, you know, when you get into disputes over is it this way or is it that way, you're distracted. You know the story of Atalanta? She was a huntress. I think it's Greek. She was a huntress. She would have been just fine today, but her father was the king, and her father said, time to get married, and she said, no, and he said, I'm the king. So she said, okay, Dad, at least make him beat me in a foot race. Okay, and if he challenges me to this foot race and he loses, off with his head, the king says. Okay, I'm the king. So, you know, she was the first guys who took the run, they all blew it, and because she just trumped him. But then came this guy, I think his name was Hippolyta or something like that. Anyway, he enlisted a friend of his, so halfway down the track, as they're starting down the track, he throws some golden ornaments out on the track, and she stops to pick them up. Mm-hmm. You can get distracted. You know, the Buddha said it's the story of the dart, and then before he lets you take the thing out, he says, who made this? You know? And was he made it out of birch? Did he put the feathers? What was, you know, and by the time you get all the answers to your metaphysical questions, you're dead. And he says, look, the trick is to put an end to suffering. And your task is to figure out how to do that. You kind of do it, it's going to be inner work. How do you reach a place where you have no complaints? Can you get there? Can you find your way there? Where that you don't contend with anyone. And metaphysics won't do that. So, you know, it's running a little late, but I was at Folsom Prison today, and the guys are wanting to talk about God and Jesus, and I said, you know, I don't have any problem with any of that, but it doesn't matter. I'm concerned about how to learn how not to make things worse. Whatever you believe, whatever your notions, whatever your metaphysical constructs. Yeah.
You know, this is my ongoing conflict. If one does away with dissatisfaction in the cosmic equations of things, it seems that one does away with satisfaction. And if that's the case, what is left?
Is this spoken from a place of? This is just thinking about awakening. This isn't awakening. You know?
But wouldn't the answer be the thing that is left? So if you're dissatisfied with something or you're satisfied with something, if you take away the dissatisfaction and the satisfaction, you have what's left, the thing.
You have your experience. Yeah. You have your experience. You know, I guess the koan for you would be to find out if that's true. In other words, right. Well, so you're asking me the question. I don't think that's true. You don't die when we start, when we stop seeking sensual pleasure. We just our attention goes to something else. Satisfaction in the sense of, I mean, is there anything that needs to be done in this world, you think? Yeah. You know? So, satisfaction in the sense of getting what you want. Reaching, you know, contentment is different than getting satisfaction. You know, contentment is really undersold in this culture.
Mm. Yeah.
And if you could be content with no complaints, no contention with anyone, you look around and what do you see? Oh my gosh, people suffering. There's all kinds of stuff to do. There's no lack of things to do. And you know, when you do that work, those of you that are involved in nothing is better. So it's I would say that it's one of these trading candy for gold kind of things. You know, the problem is that it's hard to sell the gold because it's often presented as something that you can't see. You know, it's something that's pie in the sky. But Buddhadasa wrote a piece, you can look it up on the web, you can Google it, it's Nibbana for Everyone. It says, you know, we have moments throughout the day, all the time, where we aren't craving, where we aren't deluded, where we aren't needy and aversive. We just don't notice them. Mm-hmm. And we don't cultivate them because we think we need to get something. Said Pascal, who said, if you're always trying to make yourself happy, get enlightened, you're guaranteeing that you won't be, ever. Because all, needing something to be happy means you got to set all the conditions right in order to be content. And then if you ever got it right, the whole world is just the way you want, it's all downhill from there. Because everything is going to change. So the trick is how to be content in the midst of change, to not need things to be permanent, because they aren't going to be. If you need them to be permanent, you're going to suffer.
Well, your answer seems to be love. But it's also, the love seems to be predicated on dispelling dissatisfaction. So if the whole world was...
They come together. They work together. So right view is the understanding of the impermanence and insubstantiality. The right view from the heart, or the right posture of the heart, is metta and karuna, friendliness. You know, loving kindness is what those Christian missionaries laid on the definition of sati, or on metta rather. Metta is direct derivative of the word mitta, which means friend, kalyana mitta. Mitta, friend, friendliness. So the appropriate posture of the heart is friendly and compassionate. It's the heart side of right view. And they come together. One who is completely, who engages the world, whatever the experience brings, with openness and a friendly attitude doesn't resist its changeable, impermanent nature. And the understanding goes with the heart feeling. I think they come together. It's the two wings of the Dharma, you know, the head and the heart, wisdom and compassion. You know, we can lean real heavy on one of them, but then you sort of, it's hard to get off the ground. So I'm going to thank you guys for your attention.
Thank you.